you enter New Orleans in a Google search, you'll get words and images that echo the city's unofficial motto, Laissez les bons temps rouler, let the good times roll. Let the bon temps rouler. Americans love to visit this place because, as noted TV producer David Simon has said, New Orleanians will always find a way to celebrate even when they get bad news. But there's some bad news coming to Bayou Country that no one will be dancing to. Just a few miles from the street celebrations in the storied French Quarter, Southeast Louisiana, including the New Orleans area, is in a fight for its very life.
The changes that have been experienced in coastal Louisiana since 1935 are stunning.
Virginia Burkett, USGS scientist and Nobel laureate.
A huge percentage of the coastal landmass is now open water.
The patient is definitely sick.
Garrett Graves, head of the state's coastal efforts.
And I think on an unsustainable trajectory.
The Gulf of Mexico, aided by sinking land and rising seas, has been swallowing this region at such a horrifying rate, a coastline that was a long day's boat ride away just 30 years ago could be at the city's back door in 50 years. What is arguably the greatest environmental and economic disaster in the nation's history is racing toward a tragic climax that few of the tourists who flock here know about, and Congress has shown little interest in addressing. It's a struggle with massive environmental and economic implications for the nation. Yet those involved in this fight now candidly admit two points. They are losing. And if they don't stage a comeback, most of the land in this part of the state will be underwater by the end of the century, resulting in one of the largest permanent human migrations in the nation's history and one of its worst economic calamities.
We were in an extremely perilous situation just because of the rate of loss that we had been experiencing over the last century.
David Muth, National Wildlife Federation.
And the failure of the way we manage the system to be able to build anything to offset the loss. But now that we are certain that we're facing an accelerating rate of sea level, then we go from kind of a long-term chronic problem to, I hate to use the phrase, tipping point, where we're going to go over the edge and we're going to go over very rapidly. And that rate of land loss threatens to seriously accelerate.
The causes are well known. Southeast Louisiana was built on the Great Delta of the Mississippi River. But since the 1930s, levees have blocked it from that life-giving sediment, while its wetland circulatory system was eviscerated by more than 10,000 miles of canals carved through its heart for oil, gas, and shipping.
It's been a 1-2 punch.
Oliver Hauck, Tulane Environmental Law Professor.
If you have a patient and you cut the patient off from food and water, which is what the levees do, they knock out the sediments and the low levels of nutrients necessary to maintain the marsh. And you knock off the water, freshwater inflow. The patient's already weak, right? Wheeling, not in good shape. And then you cut it up with knives? That patient's gone. We have 10,000 miles of oil and gas canals out there, and we're building more each year, just as if they weren't a problem. They have diced and sliced and cut up the marsh to a fairly well. It can't recover with those kinds of wounds.
In the last 70 years, a single human lifetime, a landscape it took nature 6,000 years to build, now sits at death's door. Some 2,000 square miles of marsh, swamp, and ridgelines have been turned to open water.
99% of our land is eroded.
Ryan Lambert, Burris Fishing Guide.
But in the last 10 years, it has exponentially gotten worse and worse and worse and worse. Like a little hurricane like Isaac, you wouldn't believe the damage it did on what we have left up toward the levee. It's incredible.
As a result, this region is sinking at the fastest rate of any large coastal landscape in the world. And because of that, it now faces the highest rate of sea level rise on the planet, something between 3.5 to 5 feet. For an area with an average elevation of 2 to 3 feet, that spells certain disaster. Tim Osborne, NOAA coastal researcher.
When you have coastal populations living in Terrebonne Parish in the Houma area, where that entire parish, 80% of it, is at an elevation of 2 feet or less, and you're talking about minimum 3 to 4 feet of sea level rise in this century, then Terrebonne Parish and Houma have got to do something, and something dramatic in terms of real expenditures of large amounts of money if they want to keep their coastal population centers in that area protected and maintain its current viability.
Now, this isn't a theory or a prediction based on computer models. This has been happening and measured by scientists for decades. The stakes are huge, not just for New Orleans and Louisiana, but for the nation. The list of contributions this coast and city make to the nation's environment and economy almost defies belief. 70% of all the migratory waterfowl on the continent winter or stop over here. 85% of all Gulf marine species rely on its estuaries. It produces 50% of the nation's wild shrimp crop, 35% of its blue claw crabs, and 40% of its oysters. On the economic side, it's the nation's top domestic producer of oil and gas. 90% of the country's energy supply moves through its coast, much of it from the 4,000 offshore rigs. And it has 50% of the nation's refining capacity. Its port is the largest in the nation, vital to farmers, coal miners, and a host of other industries in 31 states. All that is now at risk. So the disaster rolling toward the Big Easy won't just stop the party in its streets, it will cause severe financial hardship to the rest of the nation.
Will the nation survive the loss of all these things? Well, presumably.
Again, David Muth.
But it'll mean many, many, many hundreds of billions of spending on relocation of infrastructure that didn't need to be spent if we made a relatively modest investment on restoration and protection here in Louisiana.
But there is hope. After years of denial, Louisiana has a master plan for survival. It's a 40-year program that could stop the loss in some areas by using pipelines and huge openings in the river to put sediment back in its sinking basins. But it cost $50 billion, a sum this state doesn't have and Congress has yet to embrace. We asked the key scientists and agency heads in charge of this fight to diagnose their patient in medical terms. The answers were not encouraging.
I think it needs to be in intensive care. It is really a serious issue, and we have fairly limited amount of time to respond to it.
It needs chemo and radiation.
Well, it's critical, and it's on life support right now, I think.
I'd be thinking about the hospice, but there's still some hope.
The scientific community is confident in the solutions they've pinned their hopes to, but they also know not many people outside the area really comprehend what's happening now and what's going to happen in the decades ahead. And a lack of concern by Congress puts a shadow on their optimism. Carrie St. Pei, head of the Barataria-Terrebonne National Estuary Program.
I'm completely optimistic that it could happen. Am I optimistic that it will happen? That's where I don't know.
Unless something changes soon, the good times in this fabled city will be coming to an end. Anyone flying into New Orleans on a clear day now looks down on a panorama of delicate marsh floating like green lace on the brown waters of the Mississippi Delta. Those wetlands seem endless, stretching to the horizons. But scientists tell us we're really looking at the skeletal remains of a vast wetland ecosystem that presented huge challenges to European explorers back in the 16th century. But to understand what Louisiana has lost and how quickly that disaster has happened, we need to take a look back on how nature built this area and how long that took.
If you go back roughly 12 to 18,000 years.
Tulane geographer Rich Campanella.
Basically, the Gulf Coast would have formed a smooth bite from Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, through Louisiana, roughly south, right around Baton Rouge, north shore of Lake Pontchartrain, south of Lafayette, and coming out through the Texas coast now. global temperatures start to warm and the ice sheets, which covered roughly 50% of the North American continent, started to recede. They started to melt, release immense amounts of water, and that water started coming down kind of a resculpted North American topography and hydrology. Coming down this sort of downwarping in the Earth's crust called the Mississippi Embayment now, which is now the lower Mississippi Valley, you have this radically increased water flow and sediment component in that water. So it hits the Gulf of Mexico just south of Baton Rouge, loses its kinetic energy, and dumps vast amounts of alluvium at the edge of the continent.
So this huge river with this immense supply of sediment is pushing into this very flat and shallow Gulf of Mexico
right.
at the time.
Right.
Of course, not named that yet. And it starts dropping all this sediment.
Right. Well, it's open salt water.
Right.
So it deposits this sediment on the suballuvial surface, basically the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. So that accumulation starts to break sea level and start to turn water into land, to the point that the river could no longer go through its own deposition. So what it does, it leans over to the side and it starts depositing here, and this starts subsiding. The river is so huge and the sediment so dominant that it wins the battle. And it dominates the relatively weak tides and longshore currents of the Gulf of Mexico, and that's why we prograde and protrude. What's happening in the opposite direction now, we do have longshore currents. Mm-hmm. They're sweeping some of these sediments westward, and this forms South Central Louisiana and the Chenier Plain to the southwest. So there's land building going all around.
But one of the greatest and saddest paradoxes of history is that while the Mississippi has always been New Orleans' most important feature, the very reason for its existence, for almost 300 years, it's also been seen as its biggest problem.
There was always challenging elements to making peace with this deltaic geography.
Rich Campanella.
Fundamentally, because it is existentially a product of dynamism. And humans resist this. We evolved in continental environments with hard earth beneath our feet. And so we imposed hardness and rigidity on an environment that is fundamentally fluid and dynamic.
But the mighty Mississippi wasn't going to give in without a fight. The first levees around the new French colony were easily breached, and floods were common, as historian Laurie Paul of Tulane University explains.
Well, the levee system was born as an afterthought, and for many years it was very piecemeal. It was an afterthought because when Bienville first flung a few shacks down on this land and called it New Orleans, he didn't think about building levees until the whole settlement was underwater for about 6 weeks.
And when did that happen?
That would have been in 1719. There was a bad flood in 1719.
So the very first year?
The very first year, and the place went underwater. And they said, oh, well, we better build some levees. And, in the 1728, there was a bigger flood in 1735 and a real bad one in 1785, and one in 1790, 91. I mean, they were recurring.
But the river's days of being a free-flowing force of nature were already marked. Young America was consumed with the ideal of a manifest destiny, and controlling the Mississippi was a challenge it wouldn't resist. By the mid-1800s, a patchwork of taller, wider levees stretched almost 500 miles from New Orleans to Greenville, Mississippi. They were poorly designed, often collapsed, and breached during big rivers. But more importantly, the federal government was now involved. And an engineering debate about how to deal with high rivers was nearing a conclusion that would have grave consequences for all time.
You had one report by a civil engineer named Charles Ellett.
Larry Powell.
That advocated a multi-tiered response to flood control with not just levees, but also diversions and spillways and reservoirs and that kind of thing. And then you had Andrew Humphreys, who was this fanatical believer in levees only. And Humphreys won out partly because it was less costly to build levees than to do all this other stuff.
The upstart nation had made a decision to control nature by putting this beast of a river in a straitjacket. It wasn't easily accomplished, of course, and the battle between river and nation continued for decades, until the Great Flood of 1927. With the nation shocked at seeing half the Lower River Valley underwater, Congress ordered the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to never let this happen again, to build the biggest, best levee system ever. And by the mid-1930s, the job was done. The Mississippi, that great feature of nature that had drained a continent for thousands of years, was now squeezed into a pipe. That system was considered one of the great engineering feats in the nation's history, but it was also a death sentence for most of southeast Louisiana.
This land is built of mud, millennia of mud, and it sinks, it compacts, and if it's not replenished, you know, by this formidable land-producing machine, which is what the river really is, among other things, it's going to continue to subside till it's well below sea level.
Yet as big a mistake as that was, it wouldn't be a quick death for this area. The subsidence would come mostly at a snail's pace. Researchers say if levees were all we had done, the River Delta would have lived a long, productive life for hundreds of years, and the wetlands that were in place in the mid-1930s would still be in pretty good shape today. But that's not all we did. About the time those levees were being completed in the 1930s, a signature event was taking place on the Delta that would compress that disaster time frame from hundreds of years to a single human lifetime. Oil and gas were discovered in our wetlands. These days, when fishing guide Ryan Lambert motors away from the boat launch in Burris, he's fishing in what locals call the land of used-to-bes, as in, that used to be Yellow Cotton Bay, or Drake Bay, or English Bay, and dozens more. It's all one big open body of water now because the marshes, cypress swamps, and ridges that separated these water bodies from most of its life are gone. In fact, NOAA recently gave official sanction to the term Disappearing Louisiana, announcing that Yellow Cotton Bay, Bay Pomme d'Or, and 20 other place names were being removed from maps and charts in this part of Louisiana for an honest reason. They no longer exist. So where are we right now, Ryan?
Right now, we're on the west side of the Mississippi River, just off the Empire Waterway. And this used to be a community. I mean, they had people that lived here. If you look in the distance, you see the pilings from where the houses used to be. All through here, there used to be three different bayous that would run through the marsh. There's Bayou Ferrand, Bayou Chute, Bayou Cook. And across the bayou from one another, which is a slingshot away, they could go to each other's house and have crawfish balls or shrimp balls and crabs. And they go out their back door and run their trap line and duck hunt. Well, now, there's not a speck of land for miles and miles and miles out here. And they're gone. The way of life is gone. All because of coastal erosion.
When the nation finished putting the Mississippi River in a straitjacket of levees in the mid-1930s, scientists knew there would be a price to pay. Most of southeast Louisiana, shut off from the river sediment that had built it over thousands of years, was now on a long, slow walk to the graveyard, a process that would take centuries. It would take that long because sediment-starved deltas have two other ways to offset subsidence. The annual cycle of plant growth provides its own type of sediment, and the high tides and even storm surges bring in sediment from near-shore deposits. But even those lifelines were about to be broken. Around the time those levees were completed, a new threat to the region was gaining steam, one that would compress that centuries-long death march into a sprint of just decades. The oil and gas industry had learned that the layer of wetlands along Louisiana's coast covered enormous wealth. In a few short decades, more than 50,000 wells would be drilled, thousands of miles of canals dredged, and tens of thousands of miles of pipelines laid. Soon, the wetlands began falling apart. Ponds became lagoons, which became lakes, which became bays, and the coast began receding northward. Donald Bosch, president of the Center for Environmental Sciences at the University of Maryland, and a New Orleans native.
starting in the 30s and 40s, but really in the 50s, 60s, 70s, we've sliced and diced the marshes up, and that's just accelerated the rate of degradation.
Now, for most of that time, no one seemed to mind. Since 80% of the coastal wetlands were privately owned, the destruction was taking place beyond public view, and wetland regulations were 40 years away. Besides, the energy industry had brought millions of jobs and a higher standard of living to a poor southern state. And it was only following the long American tradition of turning what was considered useless wilderness into productive property.
These are lands that at one time were considered wastelands of virtually no economic value.
Mike Lyons, general counsel to Louisiana Mid-Continent Oil and Gas Association.
So people were looking for ways to make these lands productive. We happened to be blessed with oil and gas in the state, and that was the way people saw as making land, these wetlands, productive.
That didn't begin to change until the late 1960s, when Woody Gagliano, a young LSU geologist, finished a project on the Delta that reached a startling conclusion.
The gospel then was that, well, this big river's dumping all this sediment, it's always built land for 5,000 years, the land's going to continue to grow and the river may move around a little bit. But everywhere I went in the field, I saw just the opposite.
That news was not applauded or even believed by the state's political leadership.
We raised the issue for the first time.
And what was the response?
The response was, forget about that.
The oil industry had a presence in each of the state's 63 parishes and already was the most powerful player at the state capitol. But Gagliano didn't stop and soon discovered the rate of land loss had actually reached 50 square miles per year. Again, Donald Bosch.
Woody Gagliano raised the issue about the rate of loss, and then his company actually did these first, you know, change maps that were done that really kind of, you couldn't deny it.
And a growing number of researchers began concentrating on this impact, alarmed at what land loss could mean. A delta already starved of sediment was being shredded by an industry previously thought to mean only good news to the state. Gradually, the canals were singled out as the primary villain.
When we levied the river, we started a process that was, you know, measured in a 100-year time frame. And when we started to dredge so extensively, we accelerated that process so it began to happen in the decadal time frame, tens of years.
In 1972, the Clean Water Act brought some protection to wetlands on private lands, but the industry and its many supporters in politics fought back against tighter regulations. Oliver Houck, environmental law professor at Tulane University.
What is so tragic about the oil and gas industry's approach to this and the state's sort of callous disregard, I mean complete negligence, was that there were answers. They could have avoided the dredging. They could have immediately repaired the dredging following. They didn't do either. Having made very sure the state wouldn't touch them, they turn around and say, hey, the state never touched us. Well, come on. The state is just as complicit in the oil and gas damage as the industry is.
The dredging would eventually slow down because the oil and gas fields under the wetlands were playing out and the action was moving offshore, where 4,000 rigs would eventually be planted off the state's coast. But the damage had been done. Of the nearly 2,000 miles of coastal wetlands lost between the 1930s and 2010, researchers say anywhere from 30 to 90% can be traced to actions by the oil and gas industry.
I'm comfortable with up to 90%.
Gene Turner, LSU researcher.
The average loss is 5 or 6 acres of land loss for every acre of canal that's lost. There's an indirect loss.
You mean every acre of canal that's dredged?
Dredged. There's another 5 or 6 or 7 acres of wetland that's lost.
Now, with the state urgently seeking $50 billion to fund its master plan for the coast, environmental groups have called for the oil industry, which already pays some fees, to be held more accountable for the damage it caused. But the industry says its activities were permitted by the state. And besides, it's already done its share. Again, Mike Lyons.
We feel we're playing our part in this endeavor, taxes or things like that. Over and above that, I think that would be inappropriate.
Yet the state may be looking for more help rapidly because, as impossible as it seems, its dire situation has grown even grimmer in recent years. A third possibly unstoppable factor has joined the forces seeking to push this corner of the world underwater. With the planet warming due to greenhouse gas pollution, the Gulf of Mexico is rapidly rising. Scientists recently have predicted that because Southeast Louisiana, including New Orleans, is sinking at the same time the seas are rising, this landscape now faces the highest rate of sea level rise on the planet. That story tomorrow.
Where an oyster cracker on the stew, and the honey in the tea, where the sugar cubes, one lump or two, in the black coffee, the golden crust on an apple pie, it shines in the sun at noon, where a wheel of cheese high in the sky, but where gonna be singing soon. In a boat that's built of sticks and hay.
Those sounds you're hearing are not from a science fiction movie, although the story behind them could make folks in Southeast Louisiana feel like they're caught in one. Those sounds tell the story about rising tides along the Gulf Coast and melting glaciers in the Arctic, and how scientists believe those two events taking place thousands of miles apart are why the Gulf of Mexico is on pace to submerge most of Southeast Louisiana by the end of the century if nothing is done. Those sounds explain why climate change is the biggest threat ever to the future of New Orleans and its surrounding landscape. Tim Osborne, NOAA Coastal Researcher.
If you were a doctor talking to the patient, the issue really comes down to what do we do to manage the patient, manage the coastal landscape, given the fact that it's reaching a period of its lifespan that literally is nearing the end and going to see large conversions of coastal areas to open water. And that open water then is going to create a whole new set of challenges we're going to have to face in the future.
Those are the sounds made by an instrument used in NOAA stations along Louisiana's coast measuring the daily high tide. When researchers plot those readings in a chart spanning decades, it shouts headlines right out of a science fiction disaster movie. Sea level is rising faster here than on any coastal landscape in the world. So fast that over the next six decades, much of this region will be inundated by at least 4.3 feet, and possibly much, much more.
The landscape's going to be continuing to sink, sea levels are rising, and the conversion of open water is going to be the highest we're going to see anywhere in the world.
By comparison, the National Climate Assessment says the mid-range predictions for the rest of the nation are around 2 feet. Even Key West, built on an island near the tip of Florida, doesn't face as much danger. The reason for that disparity is well known. Because this part of the state is built on deltas of the Mississippi River that have been starved of sediment by levees and sliced by canals for oil, gas, and shipping, it is sinking at the fastest rate of any coastal landscape on the planet, an inch every 30 months in some basins.
The whole area has been sinking at an accelerated rate.
Woody Gagliano.
And that's speeding up what geologists call a transgression. The sea is invading the land. And it's invading it largely because the land is sinking, but it's also invading it because the land is not building itself up again.
Now, for decades, coastal scientists here were confident they could keep up with subsidence because the raw material to rebuild those sinking basins still flowed through them inside the Mississippi River. If the marshes were the sick patients, the medicine was right next door. And because the medicine would never run out, the patient could remain healthy indefinitely. But in 2007, science delivered the state a sucker punch. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change confirmed global warming was real and that the world's oceans were rising at the fastest rate in more than 4,000 years. Suddenly, the challenge facing Louisiana's coastal restoration effort got steeper because the southeast corner of the state was sinking at the same time the Gulf was rising. While many of the state's best-known politicians, including its governor and some of its congressional delegation, cast doubt on the science, some of the world's foremost experts on that science actually live in the state and know what it means to Louisiana. That includes Virginia Burkett, chief scientist for climate change at the U.S. Geological Survey and a co-author of the IPCC reports.
The atmosphere is warming because the concentration of greenhouse gases is increasing, and there's unequivocal evidence, scientific evidence that supports that conclusion, that humans are influencing the amount of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to the point that it has caused the warming, a warming of the atmosphere.
Why does that cause the sea to rise?
Oh, the sea rises because of two drivers. One is the steric, we call it steric sea level rise, which is a change in the temperature of the mass of the ocean, which increases ocean volume. When you heat water, it expands. And the second driver is the increase in ocean volume that is associated with the decline in the ice sheets and glaciers, the land ice that has declined rapidly, which also contributes to a rise in mean sea level. Those two drivers together we call eustatic sea level rise, which is the global increase in mean sea level that is caused ultimately by the warming atmosphere.
Why does Louisiana have such a higher rate of sea level rise than other places in the country?
Well, that's a relative rate of sea level rise. The rate of sea level rise appears to be more rapid in coastal Louisiana because the land itself is sinking.
But even as the state's political establishment fought against the first headlines about global warming, it was about to get much, much worse. That is the sound of glaciers calving. Since the initial IPCC report, water stored as glaciers and ice fields over land areas has been melting at a much more rapid pace than predicted, steadily adding to the volume of the oceans. Recently, instruments have confirmed sea level rise has been 60% faster than predicted. And that worries experts like Burkett.
If you look at the geologic record of how sea level has changed in the past, it's not a nice smooth curve, and it's probably not going to be over the next 100 years either. So, you know, trying to say that it's going to be exponential or a smooth curve, it's, I don't think any scientist would probably venture to give you a, you know, the what it will be at exactly 2050 or 2020, because it's episodic with changes in the ice particularly. This is from our report here. Okay, see, this is the rate of sea level rise since 21,000 years before present. These are meltwater pulses. See, so it's varied. And then you get up to about 7,000 years ago and sea level has been relatively stable. And during the past 7,000 years, that's how coasts have evolved as we know them today.
Okay. But now the projection is that it climbs again.
And as it starts to climb, the rate of coastal change will respond accordingly. And so we won't have this stable coastal system that people have built on for the past 7,000 years. Based upon what the literature, the scientific literature published over the past 5 years, indicates that, you know, the highest rate, physically tenable rate of change is 2 meters. That's 6.6 feet.
Well, unlike the state's politicians, the scientists and administrators planning Louisiana's effort to protect its coast haven't ignored the evolving science on global warming. In fact, it's written into the state's master plan for the coast, a 40-year, $50 billion project that planners say can adapt to the highest rates of sea level rise currently predicted if it's built in time. Garrett Graves, head of the state's coastal efforts.
What we did in our master plan is we looked at a range of sea level rise scenarios. We looked at a range of subsidence scenarios and a range of other things, hurricane scenarios and other factors that have a high degree of uncertainty in some cases. And we chose the projects or project portfolios that perform best or transcend all of those scenarios.
More on that story tomorrow.
what's happened down here is the wind have changed. Clouds rolled in from the north and it started to rain. Rained real hard and it rained for a real long time. There was 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline.
The changes that have been experienced in coastal Louisiana since 1935 are stunning. A huge percentage of the coastal landmass is now open water.
The coast may have, if we can make this analogy, may have smoked too much and drank too much and indulged too much and abused. It's been abused, and we need to try and fix it.
Is it in critical condition? Is it terminal?
It's terminal in the direction that it's going now.
You're in the emergency room to begin with, and secondly, you've got certain kinds of diseases you're going to have to live with. It's not a question of beating them.
If you've been listening this week, by now you know the consensus among coastal experts is that New Orleans and southeast Louisiana are headed for an early grave by the end of the century. Because of river levees and damage from oil and gas canals, the wetlands that once protected this city from the Gulf have been reduced by more than half. And now, what's left of this landmass is sinking at the same time the Gulf is rising due to global warming. When we asked our experts to rate this area's vulnerability on a scale of 1 to 10, with 10 the most dire, the responses were not encouraging.
An 8 right now.
If we don't do anything, then it's probably a 9.9.
10. It's absolutely a 10. We've lost all of our habitat and all of our land in this area.
Yet for all that blunt realism, each ended on a note of hope.
I think if 10's the worst, I would give it an 8, simply because I want to be optimistic about some things that we can do to make sure that it survives.
They all agree this area has one last chance for survival. That hope is the state's master plan for the coast. David Muth, National Wildlife Federation.
You can't stop this area from subsiding, and you can't stop the sea from eroding marsh. Those are processes that are part of the natural system. And so I think the master plan recognizes that instead of trying to hold on to what we have, what we need to do is restart the system, get the river building land again, and then strategically hold on to areas such as the barrier islands and key areas of marsh that can hold something together until the river can begin to recover the delta.
This 40-year, $50 billion initiative would use the sediment and freshwater carried by the Mississippi and Atchafalaya rivers to rebuild the sinking deltas around New Orleans and southeast Louisiana. An international core of the world's finest delta scientists and engineers developed the plan. They have put their reputations on the line with this prediction. If completed in a timely manner, the master plan would allow a portion of southeast Louisiana to keep pace with the current worst-case scenarios for sea level rise and actually be gaining more land than it's losing by 2060. The plan got enthusiastic approval in peer reviews. Again, David Muth.
It lays out a series of projects, both for restoration and for hurricane risk reduction, that are well-studied. They're implementable. They're not just pie-in-the-sky ideas. They've been tested with the best science that we have, and in many cases, they're based upon known techniques that have been used in smaller-scale projects.
This master plan actually is already underway. There are scores of projects being constructed, from small marsh creation efforts to coastline rebuilding. But to plan and build the multi-billion dollar projects needed on a timeline that will get the job done before the Gulf wins this battle, the state has yet to clear two critical hurdles. The first is federal funding. Louisiana needs the nation to pick up most of the tab. Now, Louisiana stands to gain as much as $5 billion from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill settlements, and starting in 2017, it will be getting as much as $300 million annually from offshore oil and gas royalties. But that still leaves it well short of the total, and so far, Congress has allocated only $1 million. Those involved say that's because the rest of the country doesn't understand what they have at stake in this fight. David Muth, National Wildlife Federation.
We're trying to get the message out about how important this place is. So, you know, let me count the ways. Most productive seafood industry in North America. Most important energy hub in North America in terms of not only the extraction, but transport and the processing of those petrochemicals. Largest port by tonnage in North America, so that the produce of the rest of the country, the grain that feeds the world, coal that's being exported, petrochemicals moving up and down the river, again, vital to the nation's economy. Now, will the nation survive the loss of all these things? Well, presumably it will, but it'll mean many, many, many hundreds of billions of spending on relocation of infrastructure that didn't need to be spent if we made a relatively modest investment on restoration and protection here in Louisiana.
The second hurdle is getting the people who live here to understand how quickly this disaster is approaching them, and just as importantly, what it will mean to future generations.
If you think about the next 50 years.
Denise Reed, Chief Scientist at the Water Institute of the Gulf.
Louisiana's Coastal Master Plan focuses on the next 50 years. Then sea level is going to continue to go up, and the rates of rise are going to continue to increase a little bit more next year than this year in terms of how fast. But because we're only looking 50 years out into the future, we don't really see the very dramatically higher rates which are expected a little bit further out. So if you think 50 years into the future, what can we do for coastal Louisiana given this? Well, what we can do is use the sediments that we do have as best we can to build up coastal areas that we think have a fighting chance in the years following.
That job is particularly difficult in a city whose very personality is tied to laissez les bon temps rouler, let the good times roll. Living inside these mud walls in a town where the party never ends, it's hard to imagine a disaster is lurking just a few years and a couple of blocks away. But it is. Garrett Graves, head of the state's coastal efforts.
When will the window close on southeast Louisiana? The coast.
On southeast Louisiana, much of it depends upon things like sea level rise, things like subsidence, and a big one is hurricanes. And that's always the big question every year. Remind you, in 2005, the state lost an estimated 200 square miles of our coast as a result of Katrina and Rita. And so that's always a big factor. I think if we don't, I guess, replumb the lower river system or rearrange the way that the Mississippi and Atchafalaya River system's resources are utilized, I would estimate that that we probably have somewhere in about a 5 to 8 year window to make some significant changes in how that's managed.
An 8 year window, that's not very long. If this master plan isn't humming by then, the party in New Orleans will be coming to an end.